Blog Talk Radio.
All right. Good morning, everybody. Saturday morning. What's going on, Facebook? Welcome to Behind the Blue Curtain, everybody. I'm Stan Mason, and I got all the co-hosts packing in here today. And as we do every week, you know, we touch on different things in our policing, law enforcement, the criminal justice system. And for those that are just learning what we do, we're very hard on lack of mental health for police and different things in policing and how we get reform. But let's go around before we get to the topic today, go around and say good morning to everybody. And you guys just chime in wherever you want and introduce yourselves. Everybody gets quiet like, huh? John.
Who left the window open, man? Izzy just crawled in. What's going on, Izzy?
What's up?
Man, I get and he got a new cup. He has the new cup.
Same cup, man. Giving me life.
Okay. Man, let's pop this show off, man. I'm in a good mood. Joe Mosley's in a good mood. He brought out one of his new shirts.
Yeah, man,
he's
out for
the show.
Remember the tackle neck.
And if you haven't noticed it, the chief has put a lot of hair gel into his new haircut.
It's the same haircut.
It's nothing new. Well, the gel is new, and it makes it look like it's a whole. It makes it look like you went to a professional salon and got it done.
Hey, John's full of a lot of compliments today.
Yeah, he's full of something.
You know, Keith, if you get your nails done while you was at the salon.
Did not get any nails done.
Joe, what's going on, bro?
Let's kick it off, man. Come on, let's go. We're on the table.
There you go. Joe?
Oh, I just want to say good morning, everyone. And I like the way John pressed that shirt with a loaf of bread, but it looks good.
All right. Big shout out to Big Mike over on the Facebook. Appreciate you joining, brother. This is going to be a good one today. Chief, how was your week?
Good morning. It was a week. It's good. I have to get myself mentally trained to not, you know, lose my mind. But it was a good week. Got a lot of stuff done. Had some good training. Got a lot of good things done this week. So, you know, again, this show's going to be a topic that's close to me, and I think that we can definitely do better. I know Izzy's going to have a lot to say about our hiring practices, which I do not disagree with him on. So, you know, ready to get to it.
Speaking of the Ismeister, good morning, brother. How you doing?
I'm doing just fine. I was doing a little bit better last night when I was hanging out with my friend and his new baby.
Okay, how's the weather up there?
It's not bad. It's getting warmer. It's improving. It's improving.
Psych!
Okay, well, it's nice here in Atlanta. I know it's nice in Waco, Texas. And, Joe, how's y'all's weather out there? What's it doing right now, Joe?
Well, I'll just let you know. Very well. Let me just say this: Izzy and John, you got some headed your way from me. A little something from me.
Just knowing. Anyway, we're gonna, you know, we try to touch things that you're not hearing in the media, and what we try to do is bring a real discussion into a lot of things in policing and community police relations that are not talked about, mostly because one side won't talk about it and the other side doesn't know, or vice versa. So today, you know, me and Izzy had a really long conversation earlier in the week, and we talked about hiring and how some of the problems come forward. And, you know, I think while every police department is short, and this climate of, if you want to call the people that are anti-police, they contribute to that heavily. But there's also some things that I think in the profession we have not addressed. And I'm not talking about just since the reform deal. Going back years, these things have not been addressed. So when we're bringing officers in and we want to recruit officers in and we put things out there, you get this salary, you got health benefits, you got sick time, vacation time, holiday time, you know, whatever shifts you work, we're going to give you all this equipment. There's a lot of other things that once the officer gets in there and they start seeing, that we have not addressed, which adds to longevity. And you know, so that adds to the shortness of numbers. Right now you've got a lot of your veteran officers, your 15, 20, 25-year officers are saying, I'm done. I'm out. And all of it is not because of citizens. It's not all because they're tired of politics, because there are a lot of things from a patrol officer's perspective. A lot of things come into play that I don't think the community is aware of, and I think the chiefs have to be aware of it because it happens. But the politics, the special interests, the lack of training, you know, you can put something out to the council and say, we've got all this training for our officers. But when you break that police budget down, you guys can get a copy of it in your cities. Get that budget and look at it and see where that money's going. And then say, you know, how much of that money is going to patrol officers? These are the men and women we see every day on the street where the administration says, oh, we're so proud of you. You're the image of the department. You guys make the department this and that. But they never see the chief. You know, or they see, okay, when we break the budget down, you gave $10,000 to patrol for training, but by the time we break that down for officer for training, you got what, $300-$400? And an average online class is going to cost you $300 to register, much less travel. And Chief, right now you're our resident expert on that. What do you see as some of the challenges that have come since the push for police reform, and what do you see as some of the just historic challenges that we as a profession have not changed?
Well, you hit on about 10 different points that I wanted to address today. You know, specifically dealing with things that we have traditionally not dealt with in this profession. And one of those is the biggest one is the mental health part of it. You know, we get into the idea of going into the academy. You know, we want to go, we want to serve our community, we want to help people. You know, the true real candidate, and we'll circle back to that one, that particular point. But those individuals that are truly vested in wanting to make a difference in a community somewhere, we bring them in, we train them through the police academy. We, you know, teach them tactics. We teach them the law. We teach them, you know, everything that we can possibly think of. We lack on communication, I believe. I believe that's a big section that needs to be put into mm-hmm. the academy. But we also don't really discuss what's going to happen over the long haul of a career. I mean, there may be some places around the country that do, maybe more progressive states that talk about this career as a whole, but in a nutshell, and the reason I say it in a nutshell is, you know, when you think about policing, when we go out, very few contacts that we have are initially start as positive contacts. I mean, I don't think anybody on this panel or anybody that might be listening is extremely happy to get stopped because they've been speeding or for whatever traffic violation. So we have this negative contact. Then we go and take it a step further where we have people that just simply want to argue or don't like the police or don't believe that, you know, we were doing what we're supposed to be doing. Then you take it another level and you go on these types of calls for service that really have an effect on people, like, you know, homicides, death of a child, you know, and it creates this trauma, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. And it's an over reoccurring trauma. I mean, there's no other real profession that's like this. Maybe an ER doc or something along those lines. I don't know. I haven't studied any of that. That when you continually go to this stuff over and over and over again, shootings, high violence, sexual assaults, you know, and you're having to interview victims and get delve into this stuff and hear this information and relive this information, and it's a continuation over 25 years, it's I think it's a natural human response. If you don't deal with it effectively, it's going to create problems. I think that just makes sense. A common sense approach to this is that, you know, if you keep getting beat up mentally over and over again, and it has nothing to do with toughness, all right? There are things that will happen in a career that, you know, because of the stigma of mental health, you know, we don't want to deal with it. We don't want to address it. And it creates issues over the long haul. Those are conversations that need to be had at the very beginning of this entire process. Now, I say that because we can have that conversation, but if there's not an avenue for somebody to go to deal with it, then it's just talk. So agencies need to have this mental health type of training and make it a priority over the long haul of a career. And I think you'll get a better product. And again, it even goes deeper into emotional intelligence, just very simply hiring the right person to begin with and getting them there for the right reasons, which I know we'll delve into as we go through the program. But, you know, we have to address that. It's the elephant in the room. It's the dirty secret of law enforcement. Mental health is an issue. One of the training I just went through yesterday learned that there are about 50% of law enforcement agencies in the country have some type of mental health program, including an EAP type program, an employee assistance program. But the problem becomes is that nobody's using this. And so why? So we've got to figure out why people don't use this avenue that's provided to them. So unless it's forced to do so. So we've got a lot of work to do. We've got a ton of work to do. And I think that part of it, when we talk about what this career is, needs to be a focal point at the very beginning. People need to understand what this has a tendency to do. Joe, I saw you raising the finger there.
It's very interesting. Everything you said, there's no argument for me, but everything you just hit on goes back to one very succinct issue for me. It's leadership. Now, let me tell you why I say that. If we take a Jim Devlin and look what he's doing with his operation and take these two, let's just say these two former heads of police from New York and look how they operate, and you'll see a distinct difference in leadership. I mean, if you, at least from from the outside looking in, and even Chicago, it's a leadership issue. I mean, if you want mental health to be addressed, then your leadership has to say, hey, look, we've got a problem here. Let's address it. But when you have a lack thereof of a strong leader, this is what you have. I mean, again, using these two guys from, I had the displeasure of meeting them both when they came to Chicago, they were as much as a setting of fiefdoms as anyone else I've seen. I mean, so if you've got a feudal mindset and you bring it to a police department, what are you setting up? I mean, you're as much of a gangster as the gangsters.
And Joe, you know, now over on the Facebook, Mike says, you know, tie into that how officers feel when they come into the department and management is beating up on them as well. Now you touched on leadership. Exactly. And the chief talked about mental health. And I've said several times on this show, you know, that man or woman that you see on the street, that this is the run-of-the-mill everyday officer, when they go into roll call, you know, people have no idea how many fights, verbal, take place in locker rooms and in roll calls. Because you have officers who are, they walk into work and they are battling administrative politics. And I know of a chief who made a statement in roll call, I am a politician. Now, that's the last thing patrol officers want to hear. Yes, the chief has to be somewhat of a politician and a police officer, and it's hard to juggle. But when you come in there and you get programs and things passed down to you that are not going to help you, they're going to make your problem solving, if that's what you're doing, harder to do. I think it's very hard to maintain officers because a lot of departments do not have a direction. What type of policing are we doing? Call-driven, reactive, problem-oriented, or community policing? What are we doing? There's only four directions. And if the officers don't know what direction the department is going, senior management, I guarantee you, doesn't know. City management doesn't care as long as they're not getting complaints. And the officers, you got some officers out there trying to do community policing as best they know. You got some officers doing reactive. You got some doing call-driven. And what that does is the citizens say, well, I like Joe over Stan. Not that Stan did anything wrong, but Joe did community policing, which that citizen gravitated towards, where Stan may be doing reactive policing. And a lot of officers don't even know those terms, those four types of policing. So if the chief does not set a course for the department, and you come into that department as a recruit, and you're thinking, hey, pay, holiday, vacation time, I'm going to get health care, you know, it's a job, I'll go out there and do it. And you quickly find yourself at that, you wake up and you've been doing this 5 years, broken up with two or three girlfriends, or you're working on your first divorce, you've got all this stress, and it's got nothing to do with the citizens. It's all internal crap in the department that dumps on patrol. And these are the men and women who, as the chief said, we go out to crisis. Nobody calls us because, hey, my life is great, I just want to talk to an officer. You're walking into a shitstorm a lot of times. And then you're carrying all this psychological baggage from roll call and, you know, the other things that happen in departments. So a lot of officers do say, you know, I'm done with this. I'm dealing with the people, the auditors, and all this stuff in my face. I can't deal with it anymore.
Yeah. Well, and you're right. You know, and I know this kind of gets said a lot, and it's not really an excuse for anything, but we're humans too, right? I have a wife. I've got kids. I've got life. I've got all this other stuff going on. I say that to say that we go through the same process. We have the same things going on in most instances. You know, when we respond to a call for service, whenever we talk to somebody, that is the most important thing in their lives going on right now. I mean, if somebody broke into your home and you call and somebody calls the police, we have to understand that is the most important thing that going on in your life right then and there. If you walk in with, lack of a better term, a half-ass attitude in dealing with that situation, then that breaks this whole situation. That breaks it down from the beginning, right? And I use this in the academy. I say, you don't be that guy with the cool haircut and the Oakley glasses on, and you get out of the car and your body language displays that you don't give a flying crap about this call for service, because that begins the negative right then and there. And I say that to compound that when we see that in the organizational culture of law enforcement, we need to address that specific action and attitude, because the potential for it being something else, right, in the background becomes paramount. And, you know, so we don't have a product, right? We're not a for-profit business. My business is people, right? And so my idea is that if we have the best people that we can possibly have, and they're at a level of mental health, physical well-being, financial health, then we eliminate some of those problems, and the service that they provide becomes excellent. I can't control every single specific incident every day. We are people. I have bad days. Dan has bad days. Joe has bad days. Izzy's always got bad days. But the reality of it is that when you have that bad day, you've got to take that step back and do some things that are a little different in life to get you out of that space, because you know you're about to go deal with this job and have the potential to drag that stuff with you.
Mm-hmm.
It's very easy to say, leave that crap at home. Us that have been in the business, we never left anything at home. We went and did our job. It was in the back of our mind, and it may have creeped up throughout the day or whatever. So we've got to address that type of issue on a mental health level, right? And it has to be continual. It can't be – this is not a week class. This is not one day.
That's right.
That we do this. This is for the entirety of a career that we have to talk about this stuff. We have to continue to move forward with this type of idea of this training, right? And back, lack of a better term, it's like a mental health training or a wellness type program that has to be instituted in the organization. My thought, and again, this is just my opinion, I don't care what anybody else thinks about that, but my opinion is that should be paramount. That should be at the top of the priorities of the organization, because I simply have people. I've got to take care of the people that work for me. And if I take care of them effectively and give them the things that the tools that they need to do the job, then I believe that we'll have a better product. And that includes talking about mental health and wellness. I mean, we should have been talking about this. I sure as hell wish somebody would have been talking about this 20 plus years ago, because then I wouldn't have to you know, I may have had a program already in place. But there, you know, and again, I know that I know somebody's probably going to be on here and say, well, this place has got one, that place has got one, that's cool. I'm not the largest agency in the world. I do not have a billion with a B dollar budget. So the state is not coming in to give me anything. I have to create this myself and use the resources, which thankfully because partially because of this show, I have resources available to me now that I can reach out to bring into my little agency and begin to build this type of program. I mean, I just went through an officer resiliency course. The chief of police just went through an officer resiliency course because I need to know more information about officer resiliency. I can't get enough information about it because at the end of the day, what I have working for me is people. And those people will go out and they do what I ask them to do based on expectations and organizational culture. And at the end of the day, I expect them to do a very good job. We may not be able to make everybody happy. I get that. That's just life. But treat people with respect, show them empathy, and do the job to the best of their ability. Make sure that they go home to their families and that our citizens are respectful of us. They respect the organization and that we treat them with respect. That's what I need to have in every single stinking contact every day.
And Chief, to put an exclamation point on what you're saying, and I want people listening to this to understand, and you and I are a lot alike in that police suicide, officer suicide is huge. We've done 9 shows on that already. And you know, the number one killer of police officers are not citizens, and it's not traffic accidents. It's suicide. And folks, officers are not taking their own life because Black Lives Matter is protesting. That's simply not it. I think, and I wish Dr. Olivia could call in and she could give us some, but it's a cumulative total of nonsensical interdepartmental politics and bullshit that comes down on you. Then it's, you're telling the officer to prevent crime, they prevent crime, then you're telling them you're arrest or down. Well, there's nobody to arrest, I did my job. So I think the stress level is so high, and when we talk about things that we're not tackling as a profession to not just recruit people but to keep them, mental health, the lack of mental health, because if you really wanted to do a recruiting poster and be honest, you would say, you know, welcome to the profession of policing. Don't know how long you've been married, but I guarantee you if you stay 25 years, you'll go through one, possibly two divorces statistically. And there's a high chance that you may commit suicide. You know, be prepared to be stressed. You're probably going to have high blood pressure. You know, oh, well, we don't really have an outreach program, but we've got a peer support program here where the wives of officers in the department or husbands of officers in the department are willing to sit down and talk to you and hear your grievances. Like, I really want to talk to some officer's wife, a committee of wives, about what I'm seeing on the street when he doesn't go home and share what he sees on the street. But the departments will say, look at what we have. This is good. I'm not saying it's bad, but it's not effective because most officers do not trust. Anytime the city sanctions a mental health program, officers don't trust it and don't use it because are you going to now take what I tell that doctor and use it against me?
And that's part of this conversation, and at least that was roughly some of my answer on if they only had an EAP available. You know, and I was asked this by the trainer, why do you think that officers or public safety folks don't use their EAP? And it's simply because they're concerned that whatever they share. And when I talk about EAP, it's not just mental health. There's a lot of other services that they provide, at least for our agency they do. And it's something the city pays for. But there's an overwhelming concern that information, whatever it is they share on that EAP or that they simply call EAP, that information is going to be used against them, you know. And I go walking around the PD, I tell them, we have brochures, we've got stuff that sit out, and I explain to them that you call EAP, I don't even know that you call EAP. I mean, that's just simply how it is. Now, I've been fortunate that I haven't had one that has risen to the level where, you know, they've come back and, hey, this guy really needs some serious help. At least through the EAP process, there's other avenues that come along where You know, we've had to render assistance to employees because of either an addiction issue or because of a mental health issue, and that's a whole other avenue. But we have to do everything in our power to try to help these people that we employ, because if we don't, at the end of the day, we start talking about officer suicide. We start talking about the divorce rate, alcoholism, drug use. And I, kind of what you were talking, Stan, about, you know, this the lives of police officers, it kind of made me think about, you know, these programs, at least in my mind, have to include the family.
Mm-hmm.
Like, we've got to bring in the wives when we start talking about this mental health or wellness training and or the financial aspect, specifically the financial aspect. I'd love to have the families come in and sit down with the folks to talk about how to budget and how to plan for the future, right? Don't go into debt. Get rid of your credit cards. Pay your debt off. Do all this kind of stuff. That's an inclusive deal that needs to happen with those individual members. I know there are some agencies that do that, invite those folks in, but I think that's a critical component of this as well. We have to include. We cannot do this in a silo when we talk about, you know, mental health with officers and wellness, right, or how to deal with trauma, right, to your brain, because you continually get this stuff over and over again. That stuff has got to be shared with people's significant others, or folks, you know, wives, husbands, what, it doesn't matter. But that information needs to be shared as well. So I'm not just thinking about putting this in just for my guys and gals, but I want to invite their families in. I mean, when you start, if you go back and you know, with Dr. Johnson's research, right, when she talks about suicide, there's a component of the family issue in there as well. So, I mean, that stuff needs to be brought in as well. We need to have those conversations with these officers and their families, right? And that way you have another avenue to keep watch of things that may change, you know. And so, I mean, the research is out there. The research is there. We just have to now figure out how to navigate this within an organization. There are people out there that are able to come in and willing to help. We just need to grab them and bring them in and start setting up these programs. There's not a national standard for this. I mean, for me, it's going to be me. I'm going to put this thing together, and it's a priority within the organization. Because, again, at the end of the day, the only thing I've got is people. And those people go out and make contact with other people. And if they can't effectively do that, then they need to go somewhere else. And if and I say that with a grain of salt, if it becomes so problematic because of trauma that may be occurring with them or other issues that may be occurring with them, then I think we have to fix it because it's the job that did it for the most part.
Izzy, I see you. I know you're waiting.
I mean, I agree with everything the Chief's saying. I will say that when it comes to the hiring and recruiting processes, we need to, probably not as realistically as you suggested, Stan, but we need to realistically sell the job and talk about what it is and what it should be. I think part of our problem that lends itself to the trauma that these officers experience and can experience is that narrative that you're going to be constantly dealing with the worst possible scenarios every day, all the time. In reality, in general, most, especially if you're on the beat, most of those officers, I mean, that's 95% of your job isn't going to be that. It's like 5% of your job is going to be that. But they don't talk like that. In the academy, they don't talk like that. In the recruitment videos, they talk like that, like you're jumping out of a helo and you're hitting the ground running and it's going to be Action Jackson the entire time you're here. So, and that works on two levels. That lends itself to the type of trauma that they're going to experience. They already come in to the situation stressed. They already come in to the situation with a certain amount of anxiety and apprehension. But then it also lends itself to who are you attracting to the job by selling it that way. Like, you're attracting people that operate on a hair trigger. You're attracting people that choose aggression over discretion. Like, you're attracting these types of people to this job. And if you don't adjust the narrative around policing and adjust the conversation around what policing is supposed to be, you're going to continue to attract people that shouldn't be in the job regardless, no matter how much training you give them. You can't train someone not to be an asshole. They're going to be an asshole. Like, and we don't hire and investigate these people the way we should to find out what they are like. Recruiters and the hiring and the investigators, they don't really look into, like Jim's talking about, you got to get the family involved. Like, they don't dig deep into the family. They don't dig deep into their social media. They don't dig deep into what this person is like in their community. They don't do that. They go off a checklist that's very basic and one size fits all. And if you make that checklist, they push you down the road. Because I've said before, they're like, oh, well, if I missed it, the next phase will catch it, and then we'll get them out. But it doesn't work like that because they just get pushed through. That's what constantly happens. So if we're not looking for the right people to begin with, you can have all the training in the world, and you're not going to fix the problem because you already let the problem into the job. Mm-hmm. I will say that when it comes to the training, I agree. It needs to be constant. It needs to be consistent. And also, we need to remove some discretion, especially when it comes to mental health and stuff like that. It needs to be mandatory. Like, you have to go see a counselor every week. You have to do these things. Like, it's not a choice. It's not, oh, I don't feel good. It's, you have to do this to continue the job. And if you don't do it, you know, you get a, have it be a three strikes. If you don't do it, you have not been to your mandatory meetings with your counselor, you're suspended. Like, that's it. And then when we...
Uh-oh, you cut out here. While we wait on Izzy's, now we can't hear you, brother. Your mic cut out. Did you mute yourself?
Nah, he's not muted.
Oh, wow. Yeah, we got you now.
New York Wi-Fi. You just, like, you have to get these people out of the job, because if they're in the job, they're going to cause problems, and the problems are going to spread. And if the problems come to fruition, and, you know, God forbid you have one of these serious issues, you have to make sure that that person never gets back into the industry. There's too many situations where somebody gets caught on an excessive amount of misconduct, and they're like, oh, it's okay, we solved the problem, we fired them, or we transferred them. And it's like, wait a minute, how does that solve the problem? You just passed it on to somebody else. That doesn't solve the problem. When it comes to hiring and recruitment, across the board, there's some exceptions, but policing is shit. And I honestly don't think, when it comes to hiring and recruitment, I don't think they have the tools to actually do some of the stuff that we're talking about. Like, I mean, hiring right now, recruitment right now, just in terms of numbers, is terrible. They're having trouble keeping officers. They're having trouble getting officers. And there's a high demand for officers. When you have high demand like that, bad officers are going to get in because they don't have the time and they don't have the resources to scrutinize with a fine-tooth comb the type of people that are coming through. And when you have communities that are pushing, we need more police officers, when it's police to deal with these rises in crime and stuff like that, I don't know if police departments, big or small, can really take the time to find the right people for the job. Like, there's too much of a high demand and there's too low supply of officers. Like, I mean, now you've got people lowering their standards again. Chicago's lowering their standards for hiring. They've been for years. NYPD's talking about doing it too, which I'm not for or against, but it's depending on what we're talking about. But when you're getting to that level, it's time to question whether or not the mechanisms are actually in place for you to be able to do the right thing. Because it's a mess right now. I mean, hiring and recruitment is a mess. I mean, recruitment could shift things a little bit, but I mean, if they did the ads that Sam was talking about, who the hell is going to be a cop?
Yeah.
It's not going to be. So we're already talking about a little bit of propaganda to it as well. But the whole system and the whole industry needs to readjust. And when we talk about the leadership, I feel like the buck sort of stops with them. But when you have structures and cultures that have been existing for as long as they have in policing, a lot of these guys come into the leadership positions and I don't even think they have the power to really do the dramatic shifts that are needed to change things. Like, especially when you have a mechanism like the NYPD, it's a $10 billion police department. Like, the commissioner can come in and say things, but they are a politician, and they're going to go with the way that the wind is blowing and has always been blowing because, frankly, it's easier and it doesn't rock the boat. It's been going on for too long. Like, for someone to come in and do the types of shifts that we're talking about in a department the size of the NYPD, that would be you'd get fired. Like, you'd be a commissioner for 2 seconds. Like, you wouldn't. They'd be like, thanks, bye. I mean, and all your good intentions in the world wouldn't solve it, because there's just the train's on the track that's rolling, and it's been rolling for a long, 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 long time. And we keep having a conversation around policing that just involves policing, and we don't have a conversation around policing that involves every other aspect of the government, state, local, federal organizations that are involved in the subject of policing our populace.
Let's grab a caller real quick, 719 area code 3613. Good morning.
How's everybody doing, Jared, from New Orleans?
All right, what's going on,
Brother
Jared?
Brother Stan, how you doing?
Good, bro.
No, I mean, if anything, I got to agree with everybody on the panel. And, I mean, Izzy hit on a good point, just like everybody else. But, you know, when I joined a department back in 94, and even though my career was only for seven and a half years and I was done, I mean, it was something that I wanted to do. And I think what it is, instead of selling a job, you got to sell a career also. Not a job, but it's just something that I really wanted to do. And I got to agree. I mean, you know, with some of the new breed that's coming on, I mean, I don't get it. It's kind of like a cowboy type mentality compared to when we were training. Here's another thing, too, that I've learned from, you know, some of the guys that I'm who is still active. And it's like they told me, they said what it is a lot of times, you know, a lot of the new ones that have come on, you got rookies training rookies. You got ranked that are rookies. And when I first joined, the sergeants on the platoon at 10-plus years, a lieutenant at 20-plus years, we had a lot more discretion. And granted, I mean, I know New Orleans PD has implemented some good things when it comes to mental health. But, you know, like you were saying, you got to take that stigma out of it. You know, and I mean, I've had 2 shoulder surgeries, and I got a bulging disc in my left back. And that's why I tell, like, a lot of policemen, and they know that I smoke weed every day, and it's no big deal, but it's kind of like, I smoke for my mental health. You know, I'm saving me, and that's all there is to it. But, you know, I mean, if anything, there's so many things that need to be addressed that right now they're implementing retention bonuses. For every 5 years, you get a $5,000 bonus. But, Stan, like you said, they're leaving, man. They're like, had enough of the politics, everything else. They're gone, you know, so... And right now, what a lot of people, and I'll say it, I mean, I don't care, but the New Orleans Police Department, they're giving numbers out of 1,054. They got 704 policemen for a department of a city that has a 383,000 population. That ain't good. You know?
Wow.
So,
well, hey, Jerry, I appreciate you, brother. I appreciate you, man. Thanks for sharing, you know.
Oh, yeah, I appreciate our thoughts, brother, and everybody. I really enjoy the show, as always. But, you know, I mean, hey, I don't know. I mean, I just think that the attrition rate's going to continue, and, I mean, you know, it's going to definitely take a while. I mean, there's no doubt about it, you know?
Yeah.
But, hey,
yeah.
I appreciate the show and everybody on the panel.
Yes, sir. We appreciate you, brother. You be safe out there in New Orleans, man. I know y'all just had some bad weather. Be safe down there, bro.
All righty. Y'all have a good one.
All right.
Bye-bye.
You know, in looking at the Facebook, Dr. Johnson made such a simple statement. It's so simple, but yet it says so much. She says, we need to get the professionalism back to policing. I mean, something just that simple, but it talks about all the things. We have just become a job. We become everything but a profession. And then when we say, well, we police officers are professionals, but you're not giving them the resources and the care that you would give a professional. You know, right now, Izzy hit on it. We're just trying to get bodies in uniforms. That's all we want to do. We don't.
Which is absolutely a problem.
And I'll
tell you from experience, just hiring somebody to hire somebody to get them on staff never works.
You know,
absolutely never works. I've said this go back. When we started building our department, right, we started to increase our staff. We would test and basically do backgrounds on people and get no one. So we test, do backgrounds. I got asked by my former city manager, hey, what's the problem? Why are we not putting me? I've got this money. We need to get somebody on staff. And I told him, if we do not get the right person, it becomes a liability layer. And it goes back to what Izzy said. Well, the FTO will get them. Probation will get them, right? Probationary period. We can't look at it that way. It's got to be at the front. If you don't fit what we want for the agency, then you can't be there. Just because you have a heartbeat and have the ability to get a commission from the state, I don't need that. That's part of it, but I need more. I can't take you and put you into the next level and hope that that's what eliminates you. It's got to be at the front end.
You know, Chief,
for us in Texas, because you and I came up under the same, we have the same type of system, Texas Local Government Code, Section 143, otherwise known as Civil Service. That's what your agency is. That's what my agency is. And you know that after they make that year and they become a civil service protected employee, what power that gives them, right, as far as discipline for me down to that lower level versus probationary. So that window, when we start talking about hiring the right people, that's where it begins. This is where I agree with Izzy 100%. There's got to be more done in the entry level portion of it. You have to take the time and find the right people. I'm going to kind of tie it into the business world. Do you think Fortune 500 companies are just getting anyone they can get their hands on? They're doing their due diligence because they want the right people in those positions, right? Again, they're a for-profit business, but they don't just, because I walk in the door and say, I want a job, they go, hey, come on in. You know, we have to be an engineer, even though I have no idea about engineering. That doesn't happen that way. So we have to invest the time at the very beginning to get the right folks, and it's got to be a very difficult process. Now, that's problematic, and I know people will say, well, that goes against counterintuitive to getting people to come in. Yeah. It is. But you know what? I'll work a midnight shift if I have to. I'll cover somewhere, and I'll work short to make sure that I have the right people. That's the type of attitude that agencies should have. Reimagining, if we need cops, well, okay, do we necessarily need this many people in this section of the agency? Why can't we move some folks around and maybe get some coverage here and there and better our services? I know that's a lot of that's culture and institutionalized because there are larger agencies that are like, well, no, we have this section here and it's always going to be like this. We're not going to take those people and move them to another section. You know, but I don't have the luxury of that. We're just going to have to make sure we have the right folks. But that an inordinate amount of time needs to go into that background process before they ever reach my desk and they receive a conditional job offer. There has to be a bunch of people that look at that in my organization, then turn around and say, Chief, we think this is somebody that's going to work for our organization. We are going to ask you to go ahead and give them a conditional job offer. That's how it works in my organization. My people are the ones that pick them.
And Chief, and to your point, you know, policing cannot, they still haven't understood this. And I mean, I'm just broadly painting the whole profession for a minute with a brush. It's not how many people you send to something, it's who you send. Derek Chauvin was one officer, and look at what one bad decision with a long history did. It's quality will overturn quantity any day. Getting good officers, you may not never reach your manning goals that you want, but if you've got good men and women that are going out there and they're not working calls, they're solving problems. We're going back to what Izzy and I talked about the other. We're still in policing. We're still out there working calls because it's to our benefit to show a high call load because that's how we get claims. Let's be honest about it. People want to talk about welfare kings and queens. Well, guess what? A lot of police departments are getting welfare from the government in the form of grants. So if you start solving problems and working with communities, now you don't have that call load. So what is it that you want? Do you want the high call load or not? Because one bad officer, just one, can do severe damage to your department. Let's grab another caller real quick from, wait on this computer to catch up. 618 area code 9146. Good morning.
Hey, Stan, it's Dr. Olivia. How are you?
Oh, to the rescue. I'm good. How are you?
Excellent. Hello, gentlemen. Chief, you are nailing it. This, you know, when he talked about a Fortune 500 company and that we don't just let anybody walk through the door and get a job, that's how we need to be treating our law enforcement agencies. This is a business, right? We have got to invest in the people and the process. And I'm telling you right now, I have some guys working with me at the Blue Wall Institute that we are working on this as we speak about putting professionalism back into policing. And we are lowering standards. We're going to get people coming through the door that shouldn't be there. But guess what, folks? We have some of those now. So we need to work on making this a priority because it is going to come back and it's going to get us very shortly. When that pendulum swings back, we're going to be dealing with all these people that we've allowed to come in, right? We've got a wolf in the hen house, so to speak, and that's what we're dealing with. And it's going to make everyone out there that is doing an honest job look horrible. And we need to stop it before it becomes an issue. And you guys are nailing it. And we are working on this issue as I, like, literally as I speak right now, I am building a website talking about this very thing that we can help agencies get on track.
Hey, Dr. Yeah. Olivia, if you would real quick, because people hearing this, it's easy for them to say, oh, this is Dr. Olivia. What does she know about policing? Could you just let them know a little bit about you so the listeners will know the lady knows what she's talking about?
Sure. Yeah, I'm former law enforcement. I'm also a military veteran, and I currently research law enforcement suicide and deviant behavior and such. So, you know, I've been seeing this for years. This isn't a new issue, but we've got to do something different about the culture, and that's what this show does. It addresses many issues on many levels and takes in many different perspectives, and that's what I absolutely love about your show.
Yeah, we're happy to have people like you. I mean, these guys around this show that built this show and people like you that just come that bring so much that I don't know and we don't know and the chief doesn't know. And this show will always be about the hard discussion. You might not like everything you hear, but unfortunately, you got to eat everything on your plate. You just have to.
That's the only way to fix some of these issues.
Well, we appreciate you, and I'm gonna leave you. As long as you can stay out, I'll leave your mic open, but let me go up to Big John. Big John?
Thank you. The first caller kind of, like, hit something that I wanted to touch on, and that was you guys did your job because you wanted to do the job. You wanted to be a cop. There's a lot of people that go to college. They get these degrees. They come home. They go to the service, they come home, and they can't find a job. So in the field in which they got a trade. So a lot of them now turn and say, you know what, I need a good job, police pays, there's benefits there, let me take the job. I look at, I'm talking to Joe, and Joe talks to me about family members that was law enforcement, that was into politics. So Joe probably had a longing for a long time to want to go in that route. And I know in law enforcement there's a lot of family connected to it. I don't know what sound like it's echoing. Is it echoing on your end?
No. You're okay.
So it seems that there's a lot of people that's coming to be police officers that don't want to be police officers, but that's the valuable job for them. And I don't know how can a person like that not have certain mental issues when you went to school for 4, 6 years, whatever, and you wanted a career in something, and this is what you ended up with. So you're just there because it's a valuable job. Secondly, I related to a lot of guys that I talk to that come out of prison, and they have a struggle because they have felonies, and they say, yo, man, you know what, man, I just working at McDonald's. And hopefully they'll learn how to go from the fries to work in the register one day, maybe manager one day, but it's not what they chose, their first choice of what they would want for a career, but it was something that they had to do in order to feed their family. So when a lot of these recruits get in are people who are just looking for a job. And I wanted to say this, ask Jim and guys, you were talking about bringing the wives in and husbands of police officers, and how many support groups are there by the wives on their own? Because I hear when there's a suicide, but what about setting up support groups prior to any of this, the madness? Help prepare the families where it don't take a whole lot of government money to do that. It takes just the women and husbands to come together and have those support groups.
John, I wish I could say, I hear what you're saying with support groups. I'm not against support groups, and I can only talk from my experience. And when we do this show, we bring an inside of policing that it's not what people think. We're not all one big happy family. We're a dysfunctional family in many areas because you bring in a lot of cultures together and egos and all this. And then oftentimes with spouses, be it the husband or the wife, they feel that because their significant other, who's the officer, is the assistant chief or a commander, that somehow within this counseling group, they have a special place in leadership. And then you look at officers, and it's not all about men officers with spouses that are ladies. Even the female officer, we do not go home. I guarantee you probably 75 to 80% of what we see, we do not talk to our spouses about. We don't. And they, it's not because we want to hide it. They don't need the nightmare. And so I think sometimes even with spouses, there is that disconnect. And my former department, I will give them credit. In 1993, when I started, our academy, when we got accepted into the academy, they did meet with all of our wives, girlfriends, whoever you wanted to bring. This is in 1993. And they said, this is what this job is about. This is what your spouse is going to see. This is behavioral changes you will see in them. They will appear disconnected sometimes. They will want to have quiet time. It's nothing you did. They don't want to expose you to what they're seeing. They're not keeping it secret. So my department did do that, and I thought it was a good thing because it helped. When you come home and you're in that quiet zone, you know, you don't have a spouse saying, why don't you want to talk? You never want to talk, da-da-da-da-da. So that was a good program. You know, why it's not there anymore, I don't know. But I say let the spouses find other spouses and build friendships. Because when you make it, and it's just my opinion, I'm not against having these little groups that you can talk to, but I can tell you, stand as an officer, I ain't walking into no police spouse meeting of all men or women and bearing my soul and what I see and how I feel. I'm not going to do it because if I do, it's coming out in roll call the next day, 2 days later, 3 days later. And that's a fact.
Yeah. I'm going to echo some of what Stan's saying. And I'm sure there are groups that are out there that are support organizations for the spouses of law enforcement. I can't think of any off the top of my head, but I know that they exist. If you decided to build one internally for your organization, I would say probably get somebody from the outside to come in and build it. And I say this because my wife thought that was a good idea, early on in my career, to get this organization, this group of people for the spouses and put them together, and it didn't work. It just didn't work. For whatever reasons. And I honestly, I believe the first part of it was because it was my wife. That's the reason, because, you know, there's the chief's wife trying to put all this stuff together. It got to a point where I just told her, I was like, just get out of that. Leave it alone. You know, if somebody wants to put something together, then I can assist them from somebody in the, bring somebody from the outside in to kind of help them put their stuff together. We're not going to do this. And it's simply because of who I am. You know, and I agree with Stan. You got to be careful when you have that, you know, because you don't need to be the topic of conversation during the next roll call. Mm-hmm. You know, so there has to be a little bit of separation there. Now with the family, John, I 100% agree with Stan. They need to be broadened into the process. They need to be able to have access to some of this stuff that we're talking about. You know, when we talk about the long haul over a career and, you know, becoming, you know, isolated and, you know, disassociation from the family and things of that nature, we need those eyes too, you know, with the family. We need to educate and inform them because, you know, when you leave my organization, you leave the organization for the day, I don't go home with you. I go back to my home. So I don't have my eyes on you. I don't have my ears. I don't know what's going on when you get to the house. So, but significant others and family need to know that when we start to see these things, how do we now get ourselves involved to make sure that we're not going down another road? And I say that because there are days where I come home because, you know, it's a tough job. There are certain aspects of the job that just absolutely suck. And I need a minute. I need a minute because if I don't take care of myself and get myself back to center, right, to what we call homeostasis, which is our balance, then I spend another hour or two here at the house, you know, continually thinking about this. I need about 5-10 minutes by myself to get my brain correct and get right. So then I don't waste 2 hours of my family's time, right, obsessing over some ridiculous nonsense that may have happened during the day. That's so simple. But how do we talk? Who's talking about that? Who's saying that in this business?
Mm-hmm.
When you come home, take yourself 5-10 minutes, sit down and breathe, and then move on. I've learned this I've heard this multiple times through the Department of Public Safety's Resiliency and Wellness Unit. I heard it this week in some training with TAC Mobility that I took for Officer Resiliency. It will make a world of difference. Taking that little bit of time to get yourself right before you burn up your family's time, because that family time is important. That time here that I have at my house is valuable time. Time that if I don't spend it correctly, I'd never get back. So we have to understand that when we have these conversations and with the wives and family, it's a conversation I have with my wife. If you see me just kind of zoning out somewhere, why don't you come check on me,
mm-hmm.
ask me what's going on, right? And that's kind of the relationship that I've got with my wife. Not everybody's got that. So, go ahead, Joe.
I agree with you. I mean, for me, it took me an hour to spin up and probably an hour and a half to spin down. That's the reality. And I can't tell you what anybody else's is, but that's on average. And again, that's me. But having been around this thing for most of my career, my family were police, father and uncle, basically the same time. So you figure if your shift is 8 to 10 hours, you spend up another hour to get ready, another hour and a half to spend down. 24 hours, you're down. You're out. That doesn't include sleep time. So those are issues that definitely have to be addressed. But there's two things I've got to talk about. Mr. Martin has said a couple of things on air. First one was that they hire the biggest and baddest and not the smartest. I totally disagree with that. He also makes a statement that everyone here knows what's happening, but it's powerless to put it in action. And again, I agree with that statement. I disagree with that statement wholeheartedly. A, because we don't put words to action, nothing ever happens. If we don't talk about it, then it stays in the dark, and we don't bring it to life where it can get some cleansing power. So, Mr. Martin, if you feel that strongly, please call us. But I would disagree with you wholeheartedly about, you know, letting the wolves in the hen house. Are they here? They were here before we got here. The problem now is we've got to get them out of the hen house. But, again, I go back to a very base point. Everything that we've talked about, if anyone has ever worked around on a team effort, and those who knows what a team compromise or composed of, it takes the form and shape of the leader. So if you've got an 8-man fire team, that fire team is going to look like whatever that leader looks like. If you have a tactical unit, or in Izzy's case, a gun squad, there are some good gun squads out there. Not all of them, but there are some that actually do the job right. I can't say they all do. I agree. I can say that right now. Having known some of those guys, they don't do all of them are not as bad as they seem. But that's like saying, you know, throwing the baby out with the bathwater. All police are corrupt. They're not. Are there some bad ones? No process. We don't throw the whole operation out because of one skunk. And that's what we have. You know, I think the fact that Alva's on here know that one size fits all does not work. And again, we take a look at community policing as an example. What works in where Stan and where the chief was probably will not work where I am or in New York. However, the concept does work. It works wholeheartedly. Again, I go back to something else. I sent a little flash out yesterday about the police here in Chicago saying that we can implement the DOJ consent decree within 12 years. That's not going to work. I think the other problem is, again, for me, is leadership. Can we implement it quicker than that? Yes, with the right leadership. Something that a friend of mine, Mike, talked about earlier was how police officers feel about how they get shit upon in these different units. Yeah, I mean, because everything, unfortunately, does roll down here. The chief or the superintendent in our case gives direction to the police commanders and then gives it to the watch commanders. And let me just say this. In the city of Chicago, we had 25 districts. You had three shifts. So multiply 25 districts times three shifts, that's 75 different ways of doing something.
You know,
all because we have no standardization. And that's,
you know, and Joe, and that's a good point, but it does. Stuff rolls downhill. Guess who's at the bottom of that hill? The men and women in patrol that are out there doing the job. And you know what? And this is, see, these are the things that you add to them. You tell them, you know, you're important. Oh, God bless you. You're the backbone of the department. You feed them that line of bullshit. And then when somebody screws up in any special unit or detective unit, what is their punishment? We're sending you back to patrol. And we're going to put you on midnight shift patrol. What kind of message does that send to the men and women in patrol that we're going to get everybody else to screw up some trash? So, chiefs, when you come in and tell them, oh, we're so proud of you. You guys, the community loves you. James Baldwin said, I can't believe what you say because I see what you do. So you don't get to use patrol as the stepchildren under the basement. These men and women are out there living nightmares, and we've got too many police administrators who, number one, the average patrol officer may have more time in a property room than some of them have street time. Coddled massage, they get these little political jobs. Next thing you know, they're a chief somewhere, and they're sitting up in an office. They don't know these nightmares that these young patrol officers are out there working with. They really don't have anybody speaking for them because the unions don't even speak for them. The unions are run by the people close to retirees and the good old boys, and whatever they see as a priority generally is what gets fixed. It's not what that man or woman on the street feels, even though patrol may make up most of the department. Dr. Johnson, while we have you here real quick, why can't we seem to fix things in the profession? What's your opinion? Why would we not do it, or we just don't know how to? Or
I think it's a little bit of both, and I think it's a little bit of denial as well. You know, if we can pretend there's no problem, we don't have one. The same thing applies to law enforcement suicide. We've had suicides for decades. It's not new, but until it gets the adequate attention that it needs, right, it's going to become this little mystery and this dark little secret we don't want to talk about, and then we blame it on bad hires. This is a systemic problem, and I mean, it needs to be addressed from the inside out and the outside in. In my personal opinion, it needs a lot of different things going on here, right? We need chiefs like Chief Devlin on here who want to invest and do invest in their agencies and their communities and do the right thing, bring in the right people. It's an overhaul of the whole system because, like you said, we can't throw everything out when you find something bad, but we need to start addressing it and fixing it, being accountable and transparent to the people that we serve. That's what we owe them, nothing less.
Amen.
I agree.
I agree, but I want to focus on the want part of the thing. Because part of my opinion is that a lot of the problems in policing, especially in your major departments, aren't being changed because they don't want to change them. You can change a lot of stuff, but there's no want. We've got a police department right now here in New York. We've got a commissioner and a mayor that are preaching public safety and empathetic policing and stuff like that. Meanwhile, we've got precincts that are putting up Hemingway quotes on their wall about hunting people. We've got precincts that are calling themselves Fort Apache, and we've got one in Flatbush that's calling itself Fort Jaw. That, and this reminded me of a story that Joe told me back in the day from him, of them they're passing around pins that have racial images of black men, palm trees, the Jamaican flag on them, and these are police departments that police West Indian communities. So there's a want, and there's lip service that happens a lot. A lot of these leaders, they don't want to change anything, and they'll say that they do, and they'll use all the right, you know, key words, but they won't change anything, and they won't really address issues of culture that affect a lot of the problems that we're talking about.
Politics 101.
Exactly.
And I mean, like,
but Izzy, you know, speaking.
Sorry?
Speaking from that context of the culture, though, we can put it on the administrators, but here's the truth. The culture isn't about the administrators. The culture is the people working. It's the people working on the street. It's the people in the agency. And in order to start addressing some of those issues, and I know they're there because I see them every day, and it repulses me to think that we have people in this culture that do some of these things, right? However, and, you know, cops will tell you what they hate more than a criminal, right? What do they tell you? They'd hate more than a criminal is they hate a bad cop. But yet we're not calling these guys and gals out that are doing these bad things. We're allowing it to fester in our agencies. So I would put that on as a call out of people working in law enforcement and other first responder, you know, cultures, that when you see this bad behavior, we need to have a way for them to not only report it, but to address it in an appropriate way so it doesn't backfire on them. And that we start looking at some of the things that are going on behind the scenes. Because the truth is the law enforcement administrators are they're not making the culture. The culture is already there. They just came into it. And we've allowed it to get to where it is today.
I mean, I would say that they're supporting the culture to a certain degree. I mean, they didn't create it, but a lot of times they're supporting it. Like, ignoring the problem is still in some ways supporting it. It's supporting it. The fact that the NYPD has come out in defense of these precincts that are doing overtly racist things and overtly racist cultures and are defending it and claiming ignorance. I didn't know what Fort Jaw means. That's, you're supporting a culture. You're by choosing to ignore it and claiming that you're
correct,
ignorant of cultural norms. You're
by default.
Yeah.
By default. Yes. But, here's the problem I have with that statement. Part of it's true and part of it's wrong. I'll tell you why. Now we'll go back into the issue of whistleblowing to an extent. The problem I have is that certainly you can call the bad cops out, but if that administrator who has the power to regulate, to punish, doesn't answer, it's not indeed the culture itself, it's the leader. I still maintain that the functional piece of this whole thing is the leadership, because leadership, at least in police, does create the culture.
Joe,
if you have a bad sergeant, you're going to have a bad team. It ain't the team that makes the sergeant. Trust me. When you think I'm wrong, go back to your training.
You know what, Joe? But yeah, I agree. But you know what I found, too? Departments don't become rogue, dysfunctional, and corrupt because this chief is there. Those seeds have been there. And some of these departments are historically corrupt, morally, politically, economically, they are corrupt, historically. And I think policing has moved into, or the examination of policing has now moved into, we can no longer bullshit the community. They know now. They see now. It's on video now, okay? And we all, as officers, we know. We know the shit that goes on in all of our departments. We can all tell a whole shitload of dirty stuff. And Joe, you hit on something. You know, whistleblower protection, which is one of the reasons why I had a problem with the George Floyd Justice and Policing Bill, is that there is no whistleblower protection and no mental health for officers in it. And officers are part of the community, so that should be in there. That's my opinion. But before we can even get to whistleblowing for officers, officers don't even have the freedom to criticize some of the immoral practices going on in departments every day, because if you say something, you're the bad guy. And Dr. Olivia is right when she says, we are not cleaning our house. We go into these communities and we say, tell us who's selling the drugs. Tell us who's breaking in houses. Tell us who's breaking in the cars. And this community's going, why should I tell you? You won't even, we're telling you who the bad officers are, and you won't even do anything about that. So we don't get to tell the public, if you see something, say something. And some of us know we're seeing it every day in our own departments. And it's not the majority of the officers. It's a few. But I always say when people say, you know, it's a few bad apples, that's bullshit. The bushel's rotten. And the apple cart is crooked. That doesn't mean the orchard's bad. We have to stop using these cliches as a pass, because I always say, well, it's only a few bad ones. You know what? Where are all the good ones? If you're a good one and you're watching what the bad ones do and you're saying nothing, you created these Derek Chauvins. You don't get to walk away with clean hands because you don't have anything in your record that you've done wrong. You knew about them. You didn't say anything. So a lot of good officers create these bad officers because they allow them to have the environment to do the things they do. And the chiefs, oftentimes, I don't want to hear it. You know, plausible deniability. I don't know anything about it. And they're not supervising effectively. But some of these departments have been bad for generations, chief after chief after chief. And we all know that you get this chief, guess what? They fit the mold of the last one. It all, what does your city council want? What does your city manager want? That's who hires the chief, at least in Texas. It ain't the citizens. The citizens have little to no say-so. So as long as the chief is there at the whims of the special interest, and Texas is a huge law enforcement, pro-law enforcement state, and that's fine, but everything that people think they know about this job and about the profession is not true. And if you've got an officer in your family that will open up to you, you will learn some of these things. They're not going to tell you everything. I don't care if it's your brother or your sister or your husband or wife. There are some things we only talk about amongst each other. Joe, Chief, you know that to be true. We can get in a phone conversation and talk about things for an hour or two that the community would be shocked to hear. But we've got to bring in sunshine, and we got to come clean. Because our profession, the profession, is dying because of mismanagement, inadequate training, no mental health. We send these men and women to nightmares every day. For you listeners who are trying to relate, imagine a movie you saw and you went home and you couldn't sleep that night because of that movie in your head. We're sending men and women out there. Guess what? Not only do they see this ugly movie, but they smell it. And you can't get that smell out of your nose. You can't get it out. You go into a restaurant and they may be cooking a steak and you're sitting there at the table and, boy, that steak smells like this car I just worked. That's the reality of what policing is about. It's not. Good, Chief.
You're right, and I think it's even. I think it even. And we talk about it in the context of dead bodies and, you know, horrific calls and things like that. And I actually think it even goes maybe even a little deeper, depending upon who the individual is, because trauma can be different for anybody. Could be a car wreck. Could be you grew up in a household that had family violence, mm-hmm. and now you go on the family violence call. You know what I mean? So some of these even lower end calls can cause some issue because trauma is different for every individual. So that's why some of this becomes very problematic is in this hiring process and bringing these people in, right? And this continual check back of counseling for folks, because you never know when it's going to hit. I don't know when it's going to hit. I don't know what call it is that individual went on that's going to trigger some of this stuff and begin to have trauma and then create these behaviors down the road that, you know, exactly what Dr. Johnson's research shows, right, that starts leading them down that road. So that's why, again, we go back to at the beginning of this process. That needs to be ingrained in the culture of the organization. Now, I go back to Mr. Martin's comment about, you know, we have the answers here on the show. What time is down? I mean, if you got somebody in the government that can make me kind of the police's are of the United States, then give them a shout because – I can only control what I'm in charge of, and I have the luxury, and I'm absolutely 100% blessed by the people that are my bosses, my bosses and my boss, that listen to me and hear me out on some of my craziness or what may be perceived as craziness to implement within my organization. I can only hope that if something that I do is right, that someone else close by goes, hey, how did you do that? And then they take it. And then it evolves and it moves on. It's I would love for people to pick you up, but I have the fortune of not having, you know, 5,000 levels of organization that I have to deal with, and that I'm so far removed from the newest person in my agency that I probably will never see him, like in an agency like LAPD or NYPD. I see my people. So I have the ability to go down there and say, hey, guess what? This is what we're doing. They see my face. So that's why I think when we talk about organization and how we implement these things, you know, that culture needs to change from the top down. And if it takes me every single day of staying, you know, to midnight shift for an entire year so people see me and hear me say, this is what we're going to do and this is how we're going to do it, then that's what ends up happening. You can't be a leader and not see your people. I mean, it just doesn't happen that way. You could possibly do it if you get the right people in place, but we go back to the hiring process. When we start talking about bringing folks in the organization that we expect to move up through the ranks over the course of their career, they've got to be the right people to begin with. But we got to still go back and check back on them, because even those great people, even those fantastic officers that we have out there, men and women, are going on calls and have these, some could go through an entire career and nothing ever bothers them. But we know and we see, and the research is there, there's a lot of stuff that bothers them. And we just internally suck it up and move on down the road, and it creates larger problems as they continue to go through. So we've got to get something in place. We've got to hammer this out. It's got to be a damn priority for organizations to make sure that their people are okay.
You know, Chief, I agree with everything the Chief's saying. I mean, it comes back to, though, I mean, in terms of the leadership, the powers that be don't want to really change a lot of this stuff. They don't want to do, I mean, think about, like, the when we talk about the calls that you have to go, that officers have to go on, you can solve that problem, I mean, not fairly simply, but fairly easily, if you boosted some of the social services and got these officers out from responding to calls that they shouldn't be responding to in the first place. Police shouldn't be responding to mental health calls for the most part. They shouldn't be responding to homeless calls. They shouldn't be responding to drug addiction calls. Like, they shouldn't be involved in these situations. And if you get them out of these situations, that would probably solve a good percentage of what we're talking about already. They wouldn't have to deal with this stuff that, frankly, no matter how much training, they're not qualified to deal with. But then to top it off, the powers that be aren't interested in these shifts. I mean, look at the DOJ. They just launched their new program on reforming police that's entirely discretionary, and it's got a $5 billion budget.
Yeah.
For the entire country. And this thing hit newsstands and it was touted as, like, oh, look, they've got this new revamped thing. And I'm like, that's not revamped. They've already done that. And what are you going to do with $5 million? Like, that's nothing. That's not a serious effort to actually change anything.
Well, I'll prepare on that. You know, it's hard. It's hard to implement change. When you start talking about trying to implement change at NYPD, I do not envy anybody that would ever have to be part of that process, because you're not going to be employed very long because of the organizational mm-hmm. culture of that place, right? But to implement change in an organization and a culture that is law enforcement-based is damn tough. It's hard to get people to change their minds. If you don't, if you haven't had the opportunity to do it, then,
right.
Try.
But
it is extremely hard, and I'm almost a very damn passionate. And it becomes your focal point as the leader to implement that change, and you become laser-focused on getting that done and putting the right people in the places that need to get that change taken care of. It's tough. It's easy, as you said earlier, Izzy, to say public safety, empathy. I can say that all day long, but if we're not seeing it, it doesn't matter. That's the easy way out. Actually getting down in the trenches and getting the change moving is the tough part. And for me, that all fell on me. That's on my shoulders in order to implement change. Whether it's right, wrong, and different, if somebody says that whatever you're doing is a bunch of crap, cool. But I'm doing something, right? And so it's a damn tough process to get that done. It's something absolutely different than what I've done. And to kind of go back with Stan's, that I was a patrol officer, so I wasn't in the evidence room. I actually spent a lot of time on operations side before I became a chief. So I kind of know what it means to go work.
It shows.
But it's damn tough, and I think it's easy for that person that in that large organization. I think I go back to organizational culture and organizational leadership. when you're far removed, way up at the top in that organization, it's easy for you to say all this stuff, but it's damn difficult for you to get it implemented. You got to get down in there and make it happen.
You know, I want to play something. We're talking about good officers and why we can't get good officers and maintain good officers. And last night, I talked with a friend of mine, a good officer, and we were just talking in general, and he just went into this story, as we all do as cops when we're talking. We tend to go into these stories. And I asked him, I said, can I share this story on the show? And he said, yeah, absolutely. So I'm gonna let you guys see what happens on a midnight shift in a lot of cities with a lot of officers that CNN, MSNBC, Fox, and nobody else ever cover, where the officer just needed, in the midst of all this crap that I see, I need to do something nice for somebody.
Yeah, that's fine. So it was funny you brought that up, because about a week or so ago, I went down to the Stripes at South 26th and Franklin. I went to go get in something real quick. And when I went in there, I was looking around and I saw that there was a homeless guy in there. And he was sitting down, wasn't bothering anybody. And I just kind of kept an eye on him, you know, just kept doing what I was doing. And while I was sitting there, I'd see him walk up to where the little hot food was. And he'd look at the price on the little sticker, and then he'd put his hand in his pocket, and then he'd just go sit down. And I'm like, okay. I started watching him for a second, just seeing what was going on, but I didn't want to make him uncomfortable, because while I was walking around, he'd kind of look at me and then look away real quick. So I got to the point where I just went up to him, and I said, hey, man, how are you doing? Are you doing okay? Well, the first words that came out of his mouth was, I'm sorry, officer, I'll leave. I didn't know I was bothering anybody. And I said, no, you're not bothering anybody. Are you doing okay? He goes, yeah, I'm okay. I'll leave. And I said, no, man, you're not bothering me. I just wanted to check on you. I said, have you eaten? He said, yes, sir, I've eaten. I'm okay. I'll leave. I said, you don't have to leave. I just wanted to check on you and see if you wanted something to eat or I can get you anything. No, I'm okay. I had something to eat. I'm fine. I said, okay. I said, well, I'm going to go up to the counter, and if you want to bring something up there, I don't mind. So I walk away, and I walk around to grab a few items, kind of act like I'm looking at other things too, kind of hoping that he'll get something. So I go up to the counter, and while I'm sitting there, I asked the lady at the counter, I said, has he eaten today? And she said, no, he hasn't eaten since he's been here. I said, he's been causing any problems? She said, no, he's fine to be here. I said, okay. Well, about that time, this guy walks up, the homeless guy, and he goes, hey, do you mind if I get this? And I told him, I said, man, you get whatever you want. Whatever you want here, just get it. And he gets it and sets it down. And I pay for it. I had some cash. I pay for it. I had like 20 bucks. I think he got like $4 in change worth of stuff. And so I had about $15 left over. And when I got done paying for it, I gave him the change. And he just looked at me. He said, thank you. I said, man, it's not a problem. I just wanted to check on you. I said, are you okay? He goes, nobody's ever done that. He goes, not an officer. He goes, anytime I've dealt with law enforcement, it's been, hey, you can't be here. You have to. He goes, you really, you're just checking on me. I didn't do anything wrong. I said, no. I said, because a lot of times people forget that we're people. We just have it harder than others sometimes. And we got done. He went and sat down. And the clerk was kind of almost in shock. I was like, what, are you okay? She goes, I've never seen somebody do that before. She goes, were you called? I said, no. I said, I just saw somebody that he was down. He needed help. He ain't going to come out and say it. I said, but if I could take the opportunity to help him, what's it hurting me? And she's like, I've never seen somebody do that before.
You know, I know this guy personally, and that's him. Now, that's not going to make the news. It's not going to be a topic of discussion in roll call because probably nobody in roll call even knows. But to that homeless guy, this one officer not only impacted that guy's image of the police in that particular city. You know, those are the little things that a lot of officers are doing. They're not known about. They don't talk about it. They don't Facebook Live it. And we talked about probably another 30 minutes after that part of it. And he said, you know, it wasn't so much of doing that for him. I was doing it for me. I needed a break. I needed to fix something for somebody because it's been a long night and I couldn't solve all this crap. These people are looking at me. They want me to fix. I can't fix it. But I needed to feel good about myself and fix something. And I mean, I just thought, you know, and God is good because I didn't know where I was going to bring that in, but I knew I needed to play that because we all need to hear it. In this day and age of gas prices and everybody's frustrated and angry, we all needed to hear that. And I can tell you, this officer, that is the way he is. He is that way. He didn't just do it at a spur of the moment. Go ahead, John. I see you, brother.
Telling my dogs to sit down, Stan.
Oh, okay.
I mean, I think we talk about the, you know, the cookie cutter approach to hiring police officers, and I mean, bringing up this story, I'm like, why isn't that our cookie cutter?
Mm-hmm.
Like, why isn't an officer like that what we're looking for? Like, going full scale the other direction. But I'm like, what if police department suddenly just started taking the example from that story and applying it to hiring police officers?
But
I was just going to use it as a review board question.
Well, yeah. But I can tell you guys, I know the guy personally, worked with him. This is the type of guy, veteran officer now, that the profession is pushing out. Because he is there dealing with people. He is a problem solver. He does not work calls. He solves problems. That makes his beat partners mad. Well, I caught a burglary in your beat while you were taking too long over there. And so your good officers like him who get sick of maybe the sergeant saying you're not writing enough tickets, you're not putting enough people in jail, but this guy's call load is down. His burglary rate is down. You know, his property crimes are down. And he's getting the push where the officers who don't do nothing but write tickets and put people in jail and just push a call through to the next time I got to go to it, they're also the month. They're also the year. They are that cookie cutter. Right.
It's the sort of long game thinking that is kind of absent in the conversation around reform. Because the reform conversation's been torn apart back to blue or people who are like, get rid of the police entirely and it's ridiculous. But part of that reform conversation is reform is a long game. So in the short term, your arrest rates might be up and it looks good that you're stopping burglaries and you're doing all this stuff and, you know, that needs to be done. But what that officer did, the long game, that pays off down the road. Like, if you have that type of policing, maybe people stop burglarizing houses so much. Maybe things adjust a little bit. It's a long game mentality towards stopping these things down the road. You're trying to change the culture. And there's a culture that exists in criminality as well, and there's reasons that it happens. And if we focus the conversation on reform, on that sort of long game mentality, it's like, if we do this, it may lower our arrest rates right now, but 5 years down the road, this will pay dividends, and it will improve the situation that we're existing in now. There's no conversation around policing or criminal justice has that long game mentality. We want to punish now. We want to enforce now. We want to make ourselves feel like we're doing something now, and therefore we don't follow through and we don't pursue things that could eventually make change occur longer, farther down the road.
Figures, lying figures.
Yeah.
Hey, can I jump in for a second?
No.
I wasn't asking you, Stan. I was asking the people on the show that matter. You know, the real sad tragedy here is that there are more good officers who does things that the community knows, right? And it gets buried under, it gets lost because of a few bad officers. And when I say a few bad officers, there's quite a few bad officers, but there's a lot of good officers who do a lot of good things. Some do it with their other hand behind their back because they don't want the next hand to know what it gives out with the right. So, I mean, and it's sad because I know tons of them. I know tons of them that does great things, and some of them is in the public side, some of them is done secretly, but it gets lost, and not enough of it is being talked about, and maybe that's the problem, is that cops have a bad reputation now. Cops have a bad boy image, as this guy called in and tried to say it takes the biggest and the baddest, which I disagree with as well, because I know a lot bigger and badder criminals than I know cops. So I'm just saying that because of this not promoting the good cops, the Joe Mosleys, the Jim Devlins, and with those scan in there, the Sam Masons, the Clares, what gets lost in translation is these guys, because we sit back and we talk reform. And only thing really has to do is we can sit here and blame Jim for everything that goes wrong in his department. But at the end of the day, Jim prepares his officers the right way. They have to go out and execute. And at some point, you have to start looking and say, making the right decisions. Well, what do I do here? Make the right decision. Make the right decision. And don't blame. It's crazy that Jim gets the blame for something someone does. I guess that comes with leadership, but at the end of the day, you have to stand on your own, be your own man, and do your job correctly. Everybody knows right from wrong. And I'll leave it on this note. One night my daughters went in the jar and took a cookie out. And my daughter mother said, why are you so hard on her for doing that? I said, because she waited till it got dark. She waited till we was in the room. And she snuck in there, and she knew what she was doing was wrong. And I say the same thing with police officers. There's officers who know what they're doing is wrong, and they don't need to call a Joe and say, Joe, what do you think of this? They know what is wrong, but yet they choose to do wrong. That's it. I'm shutting up.
Let's do this. We're at that 20-minute mark, and we always want to try to offer some solutions. So I want to go around and get everybody's final thoughts. What can we do? Or what would you like to see done to address some of the recruiting, some of the hiring, the retaining, your veteran officers? What are some suggestions to make an impact? And I'm going to start with Dr. Olivia, who's been kind enough to hold on with us.
Hey, guys. Well, you know, just listening to all of you, there's so many good points here. And I'll tell you, Stan, I think that audio that you just played, man, I didn't need Kleenex. No, I did. I that kind of stuff right there, it hits me because that's what it's about. We are here to serve and protect. And when we don't go out and we're not serving people in our communities, we're missing the mark. And I think we need to, when we look at hiring, I think we need to look at the changes that are happening in policing and into the career, and we need to focus on what the communities need and how we can make that happen for them. And I think we need to get back to the serving part and making sure that we're meeting needs. And it looks different than it did 5, 10, 15, 20 years ago, right? But I think we need to stop throwing out all the time that, you know, as officers are getting, you know, killed. Yes, there are bad things happening to our officers, absolutely, but not to the majority. And we need to start giving them a new narrative about what their communities look like and what's truly happening. and not letting them walk around scared all day because they're scared. They're hypervigilant. They're having mental health issues. They're overworked. They're, you know, a lot of them are underpaid. They're doing this because they love it. And we need to serve them as administrators. We need to be serving them so that they serve our communities with love and respect, right? And that audio, that said it all. I mean, that just, that played to my heart because that's what it's about. It's serving people on all levels.
All right. Well, we appreciate you. Thank you for hanging in there with us today.
Ditto. Thank you all. You're all amazing.
Thank you. Joe, how do we fix this, brother? What do you think?
Well, let me get a little philosophical real quick. I think the first thing we need to do is look at the tool belt. What are we outfitting these guys to do, these men and women to do? What is it that we're giving the equipment to do, and how do they use it effectively? And I think if we look at it from an angle of a future spec, and again, using the tool belt as the basis, then we can dissect the problem right away. And I'll leave it at that. I mean, there's more to this, but the other thing I think is we've got to get a DOJ that's realistic. This Obama 2.0 is not realistic, and we're playing with people's lives here. This consent decree should not take a 12-year process. Chicago is losing so many policemen right now; it's incredible. We can't even keep up with attrition. So, to answer your question, I think if we look at this from a philosophical side, again, start with the tool belt. What are we equipping them to do? And we'll go from there.
All right. Big John, what do you think? How do we fix this?
One is getting the right people in the right positions to do the job. You know, it seems like it's just a numbers game to have people fill certain seats that are empty. At the end of the day, you need to find the right people. One thing that I do recognize is there's an officer who could come in that neighborhood and he could seem real macho and tough. But for a dude that's really in the streets, he'd be able to read that and say, yo, that's a defense mechanism. He's really scared to be a cop. He's really scared to be out there. So, you know, you have to be able to read the officers and say, you know what, this would be a great cop. The ones who play tough may be the most scariest one of them all. And that's his defense mechanism to get from being exposed. So being able to read people and understand you're putting the right people in the right place is very important.
All right, brother. Let's see. Chief, what do you think?
Well, what Joe said, that tool belt, getting that tool belt on the right person. All right? We need to start right at the beginning. Don't expect some other portion of the system to eliminate them because they don't have the ability to do this job. That needs to be done up front. And then as we always seem to go back to, because it's always a very important topic, is the mental health of our own people. We don't have a product. We've got folks, so we have to have systems in place in our organizations that take care of our folks and let them be who they are, help them in the ways that they need help, and continually check back with it over the long haul of their career. You know, I think you'll see through this attrition. With these retirements, with these 20, 25-year officers that are leaving, that's part of the problem, is that they don't have these systems in many of these places, and they're just done with it. They're done with it. I think if we had maybe a little bit of intervention where we had somebody could come in, I think they probably would stay. And it's that's scary. If you don't think it's scary because we're losing a lot of institutional knowledge. Some of them, don't get me wrong, have got to go. They should have been gone years ago, but there are some really good ones that are out there that we're losing simply because of the BS. So this is not going to be an overnight deal. This is if we could do it starting today, if it took a decade, I'd be surprised. It's going to even be longer than that. And with that, go to Izzy.
Amen. Yes.
I mean, I agree with everything everybody said. I'm going to repeat what the Chief just said about we need to shift the narrative. We need to change how we sell the job. We need to stop selling it like a broadsword and selling it like the scalpel that it's supposed to be. We need to start hiring and change the cookie cutter, at least, to hiring for empathy, hiring community involvement, hiring for communication. I think we need a longer training period. We need a better knowledge of what we're training these officers in and how we're training them and preparing them for the realities of the job. I think policing in general, there needs to be more interagency communication and interagency learning. I hear too often the whole concept of that works there, it won't work here. I think we need to start bending a little bit more on that and start learning from other departments more. If the department's doing something well, try it out. See what happens. See how you can
try it out and alter it for your place.
Exactly. See if you can adjust it to suit your environment. There needs to be more of that, because policing, in my experience, they're very anti-learning, especially from other agencies, other countries, what have you. And I think there needs to be, I mean, we need to get good officers in and we need to get bad officers out. We need to stop this fraternal defense and protection of bad officers. We need whistleblower protections in place, because that's the reason that people don't come forward. They're not protected. They don't come forward because if they do complain, they either hear nothing happens at all, or they get punished for coming forward. So we need whistleblower protections to protect these people and promote a culture that supports them coming forward and calling out bad officers. Because if you do everything that we said, that I just said in the beginning, but then you get to a department and it's, you know, they're calling themselves precinct job, or Fort Apache, or, hey, look at this quote we have on our wall about hunting people. Isn't that cool? Or the Punisher symbol that Stan showed up. There's going to be a bit of a contradiction there. It's not going to follow through. So, I mean, if we get all those things done, we might make some improvement in maybe 10 years, like the Chief said. And, yeah, we need that long game mentality, because there's no quick solutions, and they're all going to take time. We need to understand that what we implement now will show dividends farther down the road, and stop expecting these light switch things to magically happen where everything just changes. And we need a DOJ with teeth. Because right now the DOJ, I don't care what the DOJ does. Everybody's like, ooh, the DOJ said this. I'm like, they have no actual way of enforcing anything that they say. They can't make departments do anything. They throw consent decrees. We've been throwing consent decrees at New Orleans forever, and nothing's really gotten better. Like, it doesn't improve. So that stuff all needs to happen.
You know, I'll just say, you know, my advice would be to the city managers, the mayors, the city council people, and I'm just talking how Texas government is set up, and to a lot of chiefs. If you want to fix the problem of recruiting and hiring and retaining officers, why don't you go down there under the basement steps in the dark to those men and women in patrol and ask them what they think, and listen to what they are telling you. And then chiefs and city council people and mayors and citizens, you hold these people accountable. Ask this question. What style of policing does our department do? I've said this on several shows. I'm going to say it again until folks actually start asking this question. Is your department doing call driven? Are they doing reactive? Are they doing problem-oriented policing, or are they doing community policing? It's like a compass, north, south, east, and west. There's only four directions you can go. And if that ship is, the chief is at the helm of that ship, and he has not set a direction, you got people running all over the place, policing all kind of ways. That's one of the reasons why you have a lot of complaints. That's one of the reasons why your senior officers who are problem solving and trying to make a difference, like the audio that we heard, get fed up and go, I'm out of here. I'm done. Thank the citizens. It's the bullshit. It's the lack of setting a direction. Well, we'll tell patrol we want you to do community policing, but we don't want to make the detectives mad. Like, they're special. Really? Maybe they ought to put a uniform on sometime and take the suit off and get your ass out there in the street and work calls maybe one day a month. Not only are you helping out patrol officership and building camaraderie. But guess what? You're finding out that your ass can't even fit in a uniform anymore. You can't find where your second set of handcuffs is. You can't find where all the equipment should be on your belt is, because you're no longer a police officer. You're a detective now. So when we lose track of what we are, I don't care if you're a chief, assistant chief, a detective, homicide investigator, drug enforcement, guess what you are at heart? You are a patrol officer. When the shit hits the fan and we need bodies on the street, your ass may be having to find a bar or uniform because you hadn't worn one in 10 or 15 years, and you may find yourself out there in the street working calls. And I've seen this firsthand when that happens. We had a chief years ago. He came in and said detectives would do every month, you're going to do one week, work week in patrol. So you remain proficient in patrol. We had detectives that came down to patrol. They got in the cars, didn't know how to turn the computers on, didn't know how to run a license plate. Some of them didn't have handcuffs. There was a bad scramble. All the equipment they needed for their belt. This is the 90s. You're going out into a war zone in Waco at that time. They're used to going out with a napkin in one hand and maybe a pair of handcuffs, one pair of handcuffs and one key between four or five of them. But they forgot how to be patrol officers. They forgot how, and I'm not knocking detectives. I'm saying stop to the profession. Stop shitting on patrol. Stop it. Stop coming in saying, oh, you are the backbone of the department. That's bullshit because you do nothing for patrol or very little in many departments. The detectives and special units get everything, but it's the men and women in patrol to send them the cases. So I don't care if you're a detective. I don't care that I'm an assistant chief. I'm a commander. You know what? If you don't know how to be a patrol officer, if you needed to be, what good is it? So you can make decisions, but you can't work a call. Those patrol officers they don't make administrative decisions. They make life or death or freedom or jail decisions every single day. And it's about time the profession showed them some respect, and then maybe you wouldn't have the retention problems. There's always going to be recruiting problems until we get it fixed. But with that, I appreciate everybody being here, and that's my final thoughts on it. Guys.
One last thing I want to throw out there. To all your DAs out there, can you guys all just grow a pair and prosecute these bad officers? We've got police officers that are raping their fellow female officers, and the DA isn't touching cases. Like, what are we doing? You are the lead law enforcement agent in the state. Please go after these officers. Please, you know?
Yes. Plug the crime report, brother.
Oh, yeah. Follow the crime report. Crime Report Media on Instagram, the crime report on Facebook and Twitter. Subscribe to our newsletter. Subscribe to the whole thing. We are, if you want to know anything criminal justice, we are your main resource.
All right, Big John. Cryptocurrency, talk to us about Ruffins Ruples.
Yeah, we had a little problem. But before I plug anything, I got to plug my friend here. Come here, because she's been nibbling at my ankle the whole show.
Is that Maya?
Yeah, that's Maya.
Ooh.
It's a South African Bourbon. My latest prize possession. So we ran into a little snag, as I was sharing with you and Joe, with someone as big as CBS on it, of all people. I sent Joe the letter from the trademark attorney. Unfortunately for us, we paid a trade attorney to do a research for us. He did. Came back, we could use the name, we got it trademarked, and then they turned around and CBS actually owned what we thought was our property. So now we've got a little struggle thing going where they offering us certain rights to certain things, but a whole lot of stuff that we can't use. So the big guys are pushing their weight around on us. So, you know, changing the name to our company. But still happy because it should be out within the next few weeks.
Okay.
So, And since we digging up things, because I know, Izzy, what is it, the crime report?
Mm-hmm.
Did Jim please tell everyone the gel that he used? Because not one string of hair came out of place for the 2 hours. That gel of stuff, Jim. That gel of stuff, Jim.
I don't know what that stuff is. My wife, I just stuck it in my hair.
Something about Mary.
Is out of place.
Gel? You're not messing around with that, like, hair wax?
You're not. Yeah, it's like a paste or something. It ain't gel. I mean, it doesn't get wet. Yeah.
And you know there's not one string is out of place?
It's not tough when you're just sitting here. I mean, it's not like I was running in around the house or something.
John, you can caulk a house with that hair.
Look, let's get out of here. Facebook.
Hey, I can't even say that. That's bad. I was going to say something bad.
Man, he went straight up Magnolia, Chip and Joanne on you. Caulking the house.
Anything you say about Izzy here, I'm going to take it personal because we try to go to the same barber. So I'm just letting you know now.
All right. Hey, love you guys. Everybody be safe. Chief, me and you are enjoying this warm weather in Georgia,
wow.
Texas. You know, Joe, brother, I love you. As soon as it gets warm, we'll come visit when it's consistently warm.
Yeah.
I want at least 30 days of 70 degrees in the books before we get up there. You know,
hey,
and
I was going to say, no, Joe, it's 73 here right now. Just throw that out there.
I'll call you after this one.
Hey, you guys be safe. Facebook, Mike, you know, Dr. Olivia, everybody, appreciate you guys and great information, great show. And with that, we're going to get out. Y'all have a good day.
Again. See you guys.
Bye, guys. Bye.